E2, number 12B.
So you can see very easily that these four chapters are all concerned with the Word, because each one of them really shows how can we approach God in order to know God as He is. And in order to do that, she needs four whole chapters, because that word sense is depicted first as the Word, then as the Christ, then as Christianity, and then as science. And what do they mean? If we take prayer, it means that in order to approach God at all and have any chance to be one with God, we have to approach Him not in a ritualistic way, through ritualistic prayer, not through a worthy kind of prayer, but that we have to approach Him with those qualities that are equal to God, because only like can know like. And so Mrs. Eddy would present those qualities of mind and spirit and soul and principle and life, truth and love, which have the nature of God. So that actually only that within us which is of the nature of God can pray to God. Anything that is not of the same nature as God can never pray to God, therefore can never have any contact with God, and therefore can never receive the blessings of God. This is the great teaching in the chapter on prayer, that we can only approach God through the same qualities as God. So only the Spirit of God that is within us can pray to God's Spirit. So she gives seven kind of prayers, which then are explained in my book through the interpretation of the textbook. That's now not our subject. We just build up the matrix and see the main subject of each chapter. Then you could say, now, isn't that enough? Isn't that enough to approach God, that I prayed to God? And theology usually would say, yes, that's enough. You pray to God, and if you pray very efficiently to God and very earnestly and long prayers and many wordy prayers, then you have chosen the method of how to be in contact with God. But Mrs. Eddy says, no, that's not enough. She says, you can't just approach God with some qualities of God. You also have to lay down everything that is not God-like in you. The whole in you must be atoned to God. That's the atonement. But that atonement is coupled with a Eucharist, and the Eucharist is a symbol for laying down the mortal. So the chapter Atonement and Eucharist therefore comes along and says, you know, you just can't sit in a nice corner and pray and then expect that things will happen. You have to embody that prayer. You have to act according to that prayer. And in order to be able to act according to that prayer, you have to give up everything that is unlike mind, unlike spirit, unlike soul, unlike principle, life, truth, and love. That's your Eucharist. So the demands of the Christ come in and say, only as we fulfill those demands, only in that measure we really atone with God. Therefore, at that point, the demands of the Christ are that we lay down the false concept. A key term in that chapter is that the divine must overcome the human at every point, for instance. That's Atonement and Eucharist. That she shows that we can never gain our at-one-ment with God as long as there is anything within us that is not in agreement, in spiritual agreement with God. It is a very strong chapter, because it's a chapter that says, now you have prayed in the first chapter, now get up from your knees and do something about it. Exemplify your prayer. The first statement in the chapter of Atonement and Eucharist is that atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God. That exemplification means that you have to act and do and move and be according to the unity with God, and not just have a mental attitude towards it. And so she starts right in with that terrific sense of action, which goes right through the chapter, that Jesus acted boldly. And that whole chapter is full of all the demands of the Christ to take up the cross, to drink the bitter waters, to be willing to give up everything for the Christ, not to shun back when you get into trouble. Really, it's that chapter that also shows that the Christ wounds in order to heal. It's that chapter which is, so to say, the touchstone of our sincerity, if we really mean business with what we have been praying. And to my sense, this is that chapter which makes us either to be successful in Science or not. Most people love Christian Science dearly in their heart. That's prayer. But the moment they see that that could hurt anything, they shun back. That would be Atonement and Eucharist, to stand for it through heaven and through hell and high water, to stand for it, even if you lose everything, even if you lose your income, if you lose your friends, if you lose your home, if you lose your respect from the people, if you are ridiculed. That's that chapter. And because Christian Scientists shun back, they don't want to hurt anybody. They don't want to lose anything. They stay inwardly, no matter what they read. They can read the whole textbook. They can read the whole Bible. Inwardly, they don't move further than the chapter on prayer. I always say to somebody who feels that he's not going anywhere in Christian Science, I say, well, if you want to find out why, you don't have to have my answer. The only thing you have to do is to go back and read Atonement and Eucharist, and read every sentence, and stop after every sentence, and ask yourself, am I willing to do that or not? And then he finds out very quickly that he isn't willing. Can you see the terrific import of that second chapter? It takes us out of that warm, cozy, nice corner somewhere where only mentally we are one with God, but the moment the demands come on us to exemplify that unity in every way and shape and form, where really the divine must overcome the human at every point, then we try to find every excuse why this is too early, why this is not quite right, and we make compromises with ourselves, not finding out that really Christian Science is a job for a real tough man. First, okay, he has to be a woman, but without combining with the strength of a man, you can't get anywhere, because then that womanhood is not womanhood, it's just weakness. It's tender weakness, not tender strength. So, whenever you have time, just take once that chapter and only read about 3 or 4 pages, only that, and ask yourself after every full stop, am I willing? And it's a very heart-searching chapter. And I feel without that, no one can get anywhere in the spiritual realm. If you don't have that sense that what you see in prayer, what inwardly is big in the state of prayer, what's where you stand in awe, where you are touched by the purity and bigness and gentleness of prayer, if that is not coupled by the willingness to say, and if the Christ demands me to go to Timbuktu, I go. Do you have that saying, to go to Timbuktu? Yeah? That means if he asks you to go to the worst place in the world, and you say, okay, boss, I go, then you know that you have touched that chapter, Atonement and Eucharist. So Mrs. Eddy builds up that chapter again through the seven in a beautiful way, and many, many details that are most impressive, always showing that if you take those seven prayers and say in the chapter on Atonement and Eucharist, am I willing to lay down the opposite of that which is asked there, then I am reconciled, atoned with God. So this is a crucial chapter, that second one. There are always some crucial chapter along the way in the textbook. And if we are not able to tackle that point, it is as if the rest of the textbook would never make an impact on us. That's quite clear, see. Then comes the third chapter, marriage, which builds on prayer and atonement and Eucharist and says, all right, in the measure as you fulfill the demands of the Christ and you are willing to lay down the mortal concept of yourself and of the world and of everything, then in that measure, see the comparative, then in that measure you gain a higher humanhood. She does not yet say then you gain your spiritual status completely. She could easily see that no one jumps into heaven in one jump, that it is a task that takes time to fulfill. And so on the way, she shows you have your blessings. On the way, you have the blessings that on the plane of humanhood, you experience always a higher and a higher and a higher sense of good. And only when she comes to the end of the chapter, she begins to bring in the superlative and shows that then the question comes, is there a final state of being? And what is that final state? That enormous question at the end of the chapter of marriage, well, is man spiritual or is he material? If he is spiritual, therefore is man a creator or isn't he? Or is spirit the creator? And then builds the bridge over to the fourth chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism. So that third chapter will show us that if we fulfill the prayer of mind and fulfill the demands of mind in Atonement and Eucharist, that we get in marriage the blessings of mind. Can you see? And it's a second. If you fulfill in prayer the prayer of spirit and fulfill in Atonement and Eucharist the demands of spirit, then you get in marriage the blessings of spirit, and so shows that actually marriage is the outcome of the Christ idea, therefore it is at the point of Christianity, because outcome is always at the point of Christianity. So in this way you begin to realize that only when we have within our consciousness the four, the word Christ, Christianity and Science, and we know those four, we can detect from our epitomes, which we have here, the order of the four. That actually first she tells about the Word, and then about the Christ demands, and then about the Christianity effect and blessing in the human. I said, at the end of it, she asked that great question, is man a creator or not? Is spirit the creator? And if spirit is the creator, then actually we only would have to do with a spiritual universe and no more with a material or human universe. And the answer to that is not given in the chapter on marriage. The answer to that is given in the chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism. So she closes the chapter on marriage and gives the whole new chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism. Here again, I would say it's a crucial chapter. And you can see that it is a crucial chapter because most Christian Scientists don't like that chapter, and they feel that chapter is anyway not for me because I'm not a spiritualist and I don't believe in spiritualism anyway, so I don't really have to investigate it. I don't believe that stuff. And when you look at it, one sees that one believes that stuff very much. It is a very purifying chapter, because it has as its central point really the question of reality. Is spirit reality, or is matter reality, or is the mingling of spirit and matter reality, or what is reality? So the chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism gives us, so to say, the method of how to find out what is reality so that we know what is real and what is unreal. And she brings in all those spiritualistic phenomena because, as I said, they are extraordinary. And whenever something is extraordinary, and that's something to remember today in our age, every time something is extraordinary, one has the inkling to say, this is something higher than what I have, instead of saying, this is something lower than what I have. Everything which seems extraordinary seems to be higher. And she wants to show that what seems to be extraordinary, as extraordinary phenomena of spiritualism, of mentalism, all those extraordinary phenomena which we have today and are investigated in parapsychology and so on, like clairvoyance and these things, telekinesis, you call it, you see, all these things, people are apt to think, this is something higher, let's investigate this, this is higher, forgetting that it is something lower, because it drops the tone from the material to the mortal mind. And therefore, here Mrs. Eddy comes in and says, now, look here, you shouldn't be fooled by phenomena. And in order not to be fooled, it's all about that, not to get fooled about anything. In order not to be fooled by it, I must give you the method of analysis, how to analyze what is real, what is unreal. The method of uncovering. I give you the method of how to uncover through divine mind reading what is mortal mind and what is divine mind phenomena. And third, in a third part, show how she gives the method of how to annihilate the wrong sense of reality and adopt and acquire and admit the right sense of reality. So this chapter has three parts, all three parts having to do with method. The method to analyze, the method to uncover, the method to annihilate a false sense of reality. In here, you see, you have all those big questions which say, now, what is reality? Because if you dream, you feel that all what you dream is very real to you. Is there more reality in that than in the waking dream? What is actually reality? See, these are the questions which she asks in the first part. Then in the second part, she has that question of distinguishing between the real and the unreal. Factually, that great question, how can we distinguish ideas from illusions? That question which everyone asks. Everyone says, but how can I know that when a new idea comes to me or when a new thought comes to me, if it is an idea or if it is an illusion? How on earth can I know that? And so Mrs. Eddy says, all right, I give you a method how to know and to distinguish. And then she gives the third part, and in that third part she wants to show what to do, the method, what to do in order only to accept that which is real and to be freed from that concept, from the conceptual sense of unreality. It is there where she starts writing with that terrific statement where she says, the admission to oneself that man is what? God's, not God's idea, God's own image and likeness. Not just image and likeness, but God's own image and likeness sets man free. You get the freedom from unreality, gets men free to master the infinite idea. And then through seven tones shows us how to make that admission to oneself. That one is God's own image and likeness. Yes, that's the tenor of that fourth chapter. Again, I feel always when one doesn't like a chapter, it is a sign that one should like it. That there is something within ourselves that resists really the acceptance of a great message. And I feel one can't see clear enough through that terrific chapter of Christian Science versus Spiritualism. Today you live now in an age, you all know it, where the mental realm is being investigated not as it used to be investigated, but just by some outsiders and some, what you call them, freaks or, you see, funny people, huh? But today it becomes now a part, a department in the universities where they begin to take it serious, where the occult is taken serious, where the esoteric is investigated. Parapsychology has become a big, big subject. An age where especially, say, in Russia, these subjects have great attention or even greater attention than in the West, where they begin to feel that the mental is a power that can be used. And so today we have to be on our toes to be able to distinguish the mental from the spiritual. And that's what this chapter tries to show us.